Omega Tau.
Science and engineering in your headphones. Hello, this is another episode of Omega Tau. Markus speaking here. In this episode, we're going to talk about money and cryptography and software. We're going to talk about digital money. There is a system called Bitcoin, which allows you to pay online without having a central clearinghouse like PayPal. So it's a completely decentralized distributed currency. And it's a nice example of, first of all, how money works. Second, of applied cryptography. If you speak German, you might have listened to the cryptography episode we had a while ago, which was very popular, actually. And it's also a nice example of an open source project. In the episode, we talk with Gavin Andreessen. He's the technical lead of the implementation of Bitcoin at this point. And, well, I guess I should say something about the audio quality. The original plan was that Gavin would record his voice locally and then we would join the two sound files, but his recording crashed. So what you're hearing now is the Plan B recording, which is a remote recording via Skype. And for some reason, the Skype quality wasn't that great. It's easily understandable, but we've had better sounding episodes. Yeah, just so you know. And another thing I want to say is that in the last three episodes, including this one, we've had a lot of computer science kind of content. The next two episodes, the next two English episodes, are aviation and space related again for change. Okay, that's it. And as usual, we start with Gavin introducing himself.
My name's Gavin Andreessen, and for the last couple of months, I have been acting as the lead technical developer for the Bitcoin project.
And Bitcoin is obviously the thing we're going to talk about today. And as I've said in the introduction, Bitcoin is, well, digital money. Is that the right term? Is that what you use as a kind of moniker?
The way I describe it in just a few words is it's the world's first decentralized electronic currency. Mm-hmm.
And decentralized is important to distinguish it from other stuff that's kind of centrally managed or...
Exactly. I mean, we all use centralized electronic currency every day when we use our credit cards or, you know, we pay something online with our bank account. What makes Bitcoin really special is just the fact that it is decentralized. There's no one organization or government that's issuing the currency or is in control of it.
Okay. And we'll get back to all of that later. I guess to get started, we should first try to define or agree on what money is. I think that's rather fundamental. And also, in general, in this episode, we're going to look at technical stuff as well as on the, yeah, well, the money and the economic stuff that's associated with it. So can you define money or define what the facets of money are?
Yeah, it's something we don't think about very much. But economists define money by its function. They give money three different functions. The three functions are, first, a means of exchange, basically just a system to replace barter, so that if you have chickens and I have shoes, you know, we don't need to trade chickens for shoes. We can use money as an intermediary, so it just makes trade much, much easier. So means of exchange is the first function of a money. The second is a store of value, so that I can save up some value now to buy things that I might need later. That's really hard if I'm using chickens as money, it's not so easy to store them. If I'm using something that's durable and doesn't, you know, is not going to get eaten by a fox, then it's much easier. So store value is the second feature of money that economists have identified as key. And the third one is a unit of account. So just the standard way to talk about prices. So again, if we go back to, you know, if I was using chickens as money, well, you know, every chicken is not exactly the same, and maybe your chickens are a little bit nicer than my chickens, and maybe an old chicken is worth less than a new chicken. So, you know, chickens don't make a very good unit of account, but of course, you know, dollars and euros and the other monies we think about are completely standardized and make a good money.
And I guess... you already kind of implicitly said that if I get money from you, if I give you my chicken and then you can later sell your whatever, or I can, you know, we have to all agree on what we use as money and how much the money is worth. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, when economists think about money, I mean, they have some other, you know, from those three functions, they have identified things that make something a good money. So, for example, because you want it to be a good store of value, you don't want it to decay or wear out. That's why gold has been used as money traditionally, because, right, you know, gold doesn't rust. It doesn't blow away in the wind. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes a really good store of value. Money should be divisible, so that if I don't want to pay you a whole chicken for something, I want to pay you half a chicken. You know, that's hard when you're talking about chickens.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about dollars, well, it's easy for me to send you 50 cents or half a euro for something. So divisibility is important. What they call fungibility, so that any one piece of money is the same as any other piece of money. Mm-hmm. Again, gold is great because gold is gold. Same thing for dollars. You don't really care if you get $1 note versus another dollar note, or 1 euro coin versus another euro coin. They're all the same.
Right.
And finally, economists want money to be verifiable, so that there aren't any counterfeits.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and Bitcoin does all of that and more, I guess, in a digital way.
Yeah, Bitcoin does fit all of the functions of money and is divisible and verifiable and, you know, all of these other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason I'm really excited about it, and you might ask, you know, why do we need another kind of money?
That would be my next question, actually.
If you look at the internet, I mean, the internet's this new method of communication that's global and decentralized. And one of the reasons I'm really excited about Bitcoin is because it really matches well, I think, the nature of the internet, in that Bitcoin is also this global decentralized solution for people to pay each other as opposed to communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. So I think it will really help people who, yeah, I can pay somebody in Bitcoin if they live down the street from me just as easily as if they live across the world from me. And I think that's really exciting. And I think all sorts of interesting applications are going to happen because of that.
Right. So who backs this currency? You already said that it's not backed by a government or a centralized organization, but it needs to be backed by someone or something. I mean,
well, and that's the really interesting thing that I think a lot of people have trouble kind of wrapping their brains around, is that there really is nobody backing it. It is completely decentralized. So there is no central government organization that's saying, you know, we stand behind Bitcoins and it's backed by the full faith and credit of our organization. It doesn't work that way. And instead, you know, Bitcoin is both this currency and it's an open source software project.
Mm-hmm.
So the software determines the rules of the system. And because everybody is running essentially the same software, everybody's operating under the same rules. You can think of that as what's giving it its backing. So everybody who has looked at Bitcoin and said, yeah, this seems like a good system, I think this will work, you know, I'm willing to participate in the system, you know, the consensus of all of the people is essentially what backs the currency.
So essentially, if I try to summarize, there is a magic algorithm that determines how it works and what the value is, right? And we are going to talk about this in some detail.
Well, it determines what it's worth. It doesn't determine the value, because value is tied to real world stuff.
Okay.
So the value really is determined by, just like any other commodity in the world, the value is determined by supply and demand. The way Bitcoin is designed, there's a limited supply of them.
Mm-hmm.
There is not an infinite number of Bitcoins. And then because people running the Bitcoin software and people deciding to accept Bitcoin for products and services find Bitcoin a useful means of exchange or a useful store of value, there's demand for them. So the supply and demand determines the value. It determines, you know, how much Bitcoins are worth at any one particular time.
Okay, I guess we'll get back to that later. So the plan for this episode is to look at or have it structured in three parts. The first, probably hopefully the shortest part, is we're going to talk about some crypto basics, because this is all based on cryptography. The second part will be Bitcoin from a user's perspective. So how do I use it? How does it work from a user's perspective? And then the third part would be the internal perspective. What's the technology behind it and why does it work the way it does work, and why is that a good idea?
Great.
So we should start with some crypto basics. And I think the most important ingredient of Bitcoin regarding crypto is public and private keys, right?
Yeah, that's really the key technology that makes the transaction secure and that ensures that nobody else can spend your bitcoins, that only you are able to spend the bitcoins that you have.
So how does public key cryptography work in general?
Public key cryptography is a cryptographic technique that is used to prove that I have some secret information in such a way that I don't have to reveal that secret information. It's really a pretty good trick. So you generate what's called a key pair, which is a public and a private key. And I keep the private key private. I never reveal it to anybody else. That's mine. That is the secret information that I want to prove that I have, but I don't want to give it to anybody else. Mm-hmm. You can think of it as kind of my identity. So mm-hmm. It's a way of saying, you know, this is me, or at the very least, you know, this is a private key that I control. So the public key is mathematically related to the private key, and it's related by a function that's designed such that it is easy to compute the public key from the private key. You know, my computer can do that really quickly. But it's basically impossible to go the other way, to compute the private key from the public key. Mm-hmm. So it's safe for me to give everybody the public key and say, this is my public key. Nobody can figure out what my private key is from the public key. The other piece of it is that cryptographers have invented what are called digital signature algorithms so that you can use your private key to sign a digital document or basically any piece of data. And then you can distribute that signature to the world, and the world can use your public key and that signature and verify that only somebody with that private key could have possibly generated that signature.
Okay.
So it's a way of saying, you know, here's some data. I'm putting a little digital signature on it, sending it out to the world, and the whole world can say, yes, Gavin signed that document or that piece of data. Only Gavin could have done that because only Gavin has the private key.
Okay.
Now, obviously, if you lose your private key, then you're in trouble because anybody else can pretend to be you or can sign documents. But you have to keep your private keys private. That's the whole point of them.
Right.
But to give you a real world example of something you do every day that uses public key cryptography, whenever you visit a secure website, the website software signs some information that is sent to it by your web browser to prove that it has the right private key. So your web browser sends some information to the website. It signs it with a private key that only it has. And then your web browser can be confident that you are talking to the right website. And
okay.
Then you get the little green messages saying that, yes, you are actually talking securely to your bank or to, you know, whatever website you're going to.
Right. And people might know the term certificate in that context. And these certificates are basically the thing that contains the public key associated with an entity. So you can then use that to do the verification.
Exactly. That's how that whole thing works. Right. And Bitcoin uses, we'll talk a little more about how Bitcoin uses public and private keys to implement money.
Right. We'll do that later.
Yep.
The other thing that's important here is hashes, right?
Yeah, hashes are actually simpler than public and private keys. A hash is, in general, just a way of taking an arbitrary length piece of data and then kind of compressing it into a short summary of that data. A really dumb, non-secure hashing algorithm, an example would be like the books on your bookshelf. You might decide to arrange all of the books where the title begins with an A together. So essentially you're using a hashing algorithm where you take the first letter in the title and creating 26 different buckets mm-hmm. where you can put your books. Maybe you have 26 different bookshelves and you want, you know, all the A's at the top and all the Z's at the bottom. That's an example of a really simple hashing algorithm. Now again, the cryptographers have taken it to a whole different level, and they've created cryptographic hash functions that are much, much more complex and are designed so that the values that you get out, so when you run your hash function, you get a hash value, what's called a hash value. So in our book title example, you know, the hash values you get out are just A through Z.
Right.
Cryptographic hash functions generate these very long, well, actually, they're not that long, but for example, the SHA 256 hash algorithm generates a 256-bit number, which is a really big number. And the cryptographers have designed the hashing algorithms such that any data you put in will essentially generate a different number. You never get the same number twice. And they're completely irreversible, so that if you have the hash value, there's no way, as far as cryptographers know, to figure out what data went into creating that hash value.
Right. So it's basically like a fingerprint of some data structure. And because of that mathematical property, you can know that if you get the specific fingerprint, there is only one input that could have gotten there.
Exactly. Yep.
I think that just for curiosity, the only way to crack these are lookup tables, right? So somebody computes all hashes and puts them in a big table, and then you can, of course, do a reverse lookup.
Yep, those are called rainbow tables.
Right.
And that works if you have enough storage and time to compute every single hash function.
Right.
And that's why the hash values have been getting more and more bits in them.
Mm-hmm.
With 256 bits, you cannot possibly do that. I believe if you run the numbers, that's more than the number of atoms in the Earth. You know, 2 to the 256th power is just an unimaginably large number. So, you know, there's not enough computer memory in the world, and probably never will be, to, you know, store every possible hash value for a 256-bit hash.
So we consider them safe for the time being.
As far as we know, yes.
The third thing is a little bit harder to grasp. I've called it forced work, and that is a cryptographic way of enforcing that there is no shortcut to, you know, okay, I guess you explain it. I guess you know what I mean.
Yeah, forced work is basically having your computer prove that it has performed a lot of calculations. Well, I'll talk about the forced work that Bitcoin uses to do some of its magic, and that's related to hashing. So, you know, I said that if you take some data and you run a hashing algorithm on it, you get this big, long 256-bit number that's essentially random.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't know what number you're going to get, but it's essentially, you know, a random number. The way forced work works is you take some piece of data, and then you append, you add to the end, let's say the number zero.
Mm-hmm.
Add the number zero to it, and then you compute whatever that hashes to. So that will hash to a random number. You check to see if that number passes some test. Let's take a very specific example and say that our hashing algorithm generates a number from 1 to 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some dumb hashing algorithm generates a random number, essentially a random number between 1 and 1,000. So if you just take any random data and you hash it, about half the time it's going to be greater than 500, and the other half of the time it's going to be less than 500,
mm-hmm.
right? And about one time in 1,000, you're going to get the number 1.
Yep.
So let's say that the forced work is we want you to hash on average 500 times. So to do that, we say, well, you have to find some data that when you append it to this other data will generate a hash value of 1.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because of the nature of hashing, the only way we know how to do that is for you to keep trying different things.
Right.
So maybe first you add a zero onto the end and it hashes to 42 and you say, darn it, I didn't make it that time. So you append, you replace the zero with a one and you hash it again and you get the number 963 and that didn't work either. And as far as the cryptographers know, you know, because these hashing algorithms are secure and the output is essentially random, the only way to get, you know, a modified version of the data that hashes to the number 1 is just to keep trying things over and over and over.
Yep.
And on average, you'll have to try, you know, let's see, I guess you'd have to try 1,000 times on average to make it hash to the value 1.
Yeah.
So they know that you had to perform on average 1,000 hashes to make it pass that test. And that's forced work.
Okay.
So it's very easy for anybody to check to see that the data does actually hash to the value 1. You just need to run the hash algorithm once. But to actually get it to produce that value, you had to do the hash 1,000 times. So you had to do 1,000 times as much work to get something that everybody can check just by running the hash algorithm once.
Okay. And the reason why this works is because the reverse doesn't work. The reverse lookup doesn't work. You can't just say, I want the 1, so calculate the input. And it works because of the statistical properties of how likely it is. If you basically use random as the underlying likelihood, then you know how often you have to do the calculation. That's the trick.
Exactly right.
And you guys, listeners, might wonder why this is important, but we'll talk about that later. We just wanted to get some crypto basics out of the way before we then talk about how they are used. So let's look at Bitcoin from a user's perspective. So the idea is now to consider probably me, who has no idea about how Bitcoin works as of now, and I want to use Bitcoin to pay stuff. So I guess if we talk about coins or money as the analogy, I need some kind of wallet, somewhere, some place to keep my money. How do I? It's probably some software, I guess, right?
Yeah, there's actually two solutions right now. The easiest solution is to keep your wallet at an online wallet service.
Oh, yeah.
There are websites where you can sign up for free. They will give you a Bitcoin wallet where you can have people send Bitcoins to it. You can keep your Bitcoins there, and then, you know, using just a web interface, you can send your Bitcoins to anybody else. That's certainly the easiest right now. The one problem with that is you do have to trust the online wallet service to keep your coins safe, and that they're not going to disappear. They're not going to go out of business and, you know, you lose your online wallet.
Right.
So if you want to go the do-it-yourself, trust nobody route, you can download the open source Bitcoin software, run that on your computer, and it will create a wallet file that lives on your computer. So okay. The wallet file contains all of the private keys that we talked about. The only downside of doing that is you have to be careful and responsible to make sure that there's no viruses on your computer that could steal that wallet, that you back it up regularly so that if your computer catches on fire, you're not going to lose all of your Bitcoin.
Right.
But I think most people now are probably going that route. They're downloading the Bitcoin software, running it on their computer, and it then connects to all of the other computers running Bitcoin, so you can get Bitcoins and send them to other people.
So now I have an empty wallet, right?
Yep.
How do I get money that I can spend? Can I buy Bitcoins, or do they show up randomly? How does this work?
You can. You'll have when you either run Bitcoin or when you get an account at an online Bitcoin wallet service, you will get a Bitcoin receiving address, which is this big, long 35 numbers and characters beginning with the number one. Behind the scenes, that's actually essentially your public key. Mm-hmm. So if you give that to other people, they can then send Bitcoins to that public key, and only you will be able to spend them because you're the only person who has the corresponding private key. Mm-hmm. You asked, you know, how do you get people to do that? Well, there are Bitcoin exchanges where you can exchange Bitcoins for euros, Bitcoins for dollars, okay. Dollars for Bitcoins, euros for Bitcoins. And you can sign up with these exchanges. And then many of the exchanges work like a stock market so that the supply and demand determine the price. So mm-hmm. you can make bids on, you know, I want to buy 500 Bitcoins for 400 euros or whatever you're willing to pay. And then the exchange will take care of, you know, getting Bitcoins from the person who has them and sending them to your account.
So I can't just create new Bitcoins. I actually have to find somebody else who currently owns Bitcoins, and I basically have to buy them from them. And this buying, of course, is called exchange in this case.
That's the easiest way to get Bitcoins. And we haven't talked about how Bitcoins are created.
Right.
But if you are patient, you can actually create Bitcoins using your computer. And
okay.
Why don't we hold off and talk about that a little bit later?
Okay, right, because this is a technical...
Yep, because there is a way actually of getting them without buying them from anybody or trading them from anybody.
Okay.
Although that's getting harder and harder over time. And
right, let's talk about that later. After all, if I want to get some dollars, I also have to exchange them and in effect buy them from somebody who has them. So that's fine.
Exactly, or get yourself hired for doing some work,
right,
or whatever. Yep.
Right. So how do I pay? Assuming I do have some Bitcoins, then how do I use the Bitcoin client, which I think exists, to actually do a payment?
Well, you need to know the Bitcoin address of whoever you want to pay. In some cases, those are just published on the web.
Mm-hmm.
So there are several charities who are accepting Bitcoins as donations. So let's say you wanted to donate to your you know, favorite charity that accepts Bitcoins. Well, they'll publish their Bitcoin address, that public, everybody knows address on their website. You just copy and paste that address into your Bitcoin software, type in how much you want to pay, and press the pay button, and the Bitcoins will be transferred from you to them. Okay. That's it.
So what you need basically is the public key of the receiver, and then that's basically how it works.
Exactly, yes. And now, if you're actually buying like a product for Bitcoins, these online wallet services that I was talking about typically have kind of like PayPal has buttons that merchants can put on their websites that says pay using Bitcoin. And then they have a whole payment process that will, again, give you a Bitcoin address you can send your coins to. And for a merchant, it's important to know who is paying them. And, you know, for a charity, they probably don't really care who is sending them money. They just care that they get money. For a merchant that is going to send you socks for Bitcoins, they do care. So these merchant services essentially generate a new Bitcoin address for every transaction so that the company receiving the Bitcoins knows, you know, I got 49 Bitcoins paid to this Bitcoin address, and that corresponds to this order for three pairs of socks or whatever.
So that's actually a good segue into my next question. You said before that there is a private public key pair that is used to manage basically the mechanics of how the system works. Can I be tracked then based on the public key? I mean, everybody sees my public key when I pay something, right?
Right. Well, it depends because you don't have just one public-private key pair. You may have many, many public-private key pairs.
Okay.
So I talk about merchants who have, you know, hundreds of customers. They need to know, you know, who is paying them. So typically for every transaction, they'll generate a new public and private key so that they can track every transaction.
Okay.
And just the fact that, you know, one person has potentially hundreds of public and private keys actually makes it very hard to track.
So in other words, I could create a new public-private key pair for everything I buy with Bitcoins, so there is no paper trail or no bit trail that links all of my purchases together by the same public key.
Essentially, I mean, there is actually kind of a fuzzy trail, because let's say you received 50 Bitcoins from three different people on potentially three different, you know, public-private key pairs, so three different Bitcoin addresses.
Mm-hmm.
But then you made a payment for 150 Bitcoins to a store. I mean, the store will be able to see that you got those Bitcoins from three different addresses. The store probably has no way of knowing who the people are who sent you the Bitcoins.
Okay.
They know who you are because obviously, you know, if you're dealing with a store, they need to send you whatever product you bought. But they don't know who the people are you got the Bitcoins from, and they probably have very little way of knowing, you know, what other things are you buying. There's no easy way for them to tell.
Okay. So this is interesting. So Bitcoins aren't just numbers. Like if I do a bank transaction where I just say I send 50 euros or $50 to somebody else, these Bitcoins actually have, let's say, each Bitcoin actually has some kind of identity that can be tracked through its life, almost like the unique numbers on dollar notes.
Yes, that's true. And cool. Bitcoins are a little bit different than dollar notes because they're constantly being kind of split apart and merged back together.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the way the software works. We can get into that in a little while.
Yeah.
Going back to the tracking, I would say Bitcoins are much more anonymous than typical online payments like credit cards or PayPal, because there is no central organization that's keeping track of all of your transactions.
Mm-hmm.
But they are less anonymous than, you know, like in-person cash transactions. Because there is some connection between your purchases in that your Bitcoins kind of get mixed together into your wallet. So there are all sorts of theoretical ways that somebody watching the transactions on the network might possibly be able to figure out, you know, this person paid 50 Bitcoins here and 25 Bitcoins here, and it's probably the same person.
Okay.
So it's not entirely anonymous. There is some kind of information leakage as Bitcoins are combined together and then split back apart to make all of your purchases. But it's pretty darn good. So certainly better than the existing online payment solutions we have these days.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one question is, what's the value of a Bitcoin? But we'll talk about that when we talk about the technology. However, what happens with my money, with my Bitcoin money, if Bitcoin goes away, whatever that exactly means? Can it go away? Can it be shut down? I mean, you know, what happens if Bitcoin doesn't exist anymore?
Well, then your money goes away.
Okay. Bad.
It'd be like saying, you know, what if the United States government went bankrupt and said, you know, we're not honoring dollars anymore? It almost doesn't even make sense in with centralized currencies, because probably people would still be trading them because they still function as a useful money. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's decentralized, so there is no easy way for a government or anybody else to shut it down. I mean, I suppose you could imagine if there was some bug in the software that somebody could make, you know, every piece of software running Bitcoin crash at the same time, you know, that could shut down the network. Although I believe any such bug will get fixed quickly and be back up and running, and you'd be able to spend your Bitcoins again. Beyond that, it's hard to imagine how it could be shut down. It's certainly possible that at some point something better will come along to replace Bitcoins. That can always happen with any technology. And in that case, you know, the value of Bitcoins would go down and the value of whatever other money was being used would go up. At this point, I would advise people not to make heavy investments in Bitcoin. It's new. And although, as far as we can tell, the system is solid, you know, you should consider any Bitcoins you have as kind of like a high-risk investment. You know, don't put money in Bitcoins that you can't afford to lose, because there could be a nasty bug that has to get fixed, and it means you can't spend your Bitcoins for a day or 3 days or a week. Lots of things could happen because it is early days yet. I mean, Bitcoin was invented, a little over 2 years ago.
Right.
And 2 years is not very long for a money to really become solid, you know, to become trusted and stable and, you know, all the other things you want for money.
So is this legal?
As far as we know, it's legal in the United States. I believe it's legal in all the other countries I've heard of. You can do illegal things with Bitcoin, certainly.
Sure.
But just using Bitcoins should be perfectly legal. It's essentially just an electronic commodity. You know, you're trading these tokens with each other, and what you and somebody else decide those tokens are worth is up to you. Mm. There are, at least I know in the United States, there are various money laundering and other regulations that typically impact you when you're, for example, converting dollars into Bitcoins. You know, various reporting requirements and other things that the Bitcoin exchanges are subject to, assuming that they're in the United States. So if you converted more than 10,000 US dollars into Bitcoins, there's some paperwork that the exchange would have to fill out and send to the United States federal government to try to prevent money laundering. And there are other things like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, if you are running a Bitcoin-based business for the purposes of taxes, Bitcoins are probably covered by the same rules that cover barter transactions. So at least I know in the United States, it doesn't matter if you're trading dollars for your product or service versus, well, chickens for your product or service. The tax man still wants you to put a value on, you know, those transactions and pay taxes on them. And Bitcoins are no different than that.
Okay. Good. I guess that should be enough from a user's perspective. We'll, in the wrap-up at the end, we'll talk about adoption, who uses it and stuff. But let's look at the technology now to make it way more concrete.
Sure.
So should we try to explain what a coin is? We already said it's virtual. It has some kind of identity, right? So how do we track the life, if you will, of a coin?
Well, I should say under the covers inside Bitcoin, there actually are no coins. There are only transactions.
Okay.
So there are only transfers of value from one entity to another. And the way the whole thing gets started is there are coins created out of nothing. So there are transactions that assign value to somebody's public key, just kind of out of thin air.
Okay. That's a little bit like digging gold, right? I mean, you just dig around and you find gold and you're rich. So is that the same? Is that a good analogy for that?
Yeah, that's actually a very good analogy. The code inside the Bitcoin client that creates new Bitcoins is called the Bitcoin miner. So it is like digging some precious metal out of the ground. Well, and maybe we should save how Bitcoins are actually created, because that gets a little more technical. But you can take it on faith that once a Bitcoin is created, or once some Bitcoins are created, once there's this transaction that creates new Bitcoins out of thin air, then everything is built on top of that. So when I receive Bitcoins, you know, somebody has created a transaction that reassigns them from the public key that they used to be assigned to my private key. And so the whole system is oriented around these transactions, and the amounts in the transactions are actually arbitrary amounts. So I can transfer half a Bitcoin just as easily as I can transfer 2 million Bitcoins. I mean, to the system, it's just, you know, a number in the transaction.
Okay. So how does the system keep track of the transactions if there is no, I mean, you know, I'm a software person. One way of doing that is you have a central database where all transactions are stored, and therefore you can keep track, but you don't want it to be a central organization. So there is no central database. How else does it work then?
Yeah, that's the key problem that Satoshi solved. So instead of having a central database, we have a distributed database. So when you run the Bitcoin software, you are watching all of the transactions that are transmitted across the Bitcoin network. I mean, you're looking for transactions that involve the public keys in your wallet, and you're storing the transactions that everybody else has made. So instead of one central computer deciding which transactions are valid and who's making, you know, what transactions, everybody on the network is watching the transactions and making those decisions.
And how do they make the decision whether something is valid? How do they know?
Well, first, they make sure that the Bitcoins weren't spent before. So since I'm watching the transactions going across the network, if I see two transactions that spend the same coins, then I will say that the second transaction is invalid, doesn't count. The first one I see is the one that I consider valid.
How do we know that? I mean, if Bitcoins don't have an identity, as we just said, how do we know it's the same Bitcoin?
So when you see a transaction, there are two types of transaction. There are these first transactions that we haven't really talked about that create Bitcoins out of thin air.
Right.
And let's put those to the side just for a second.
Yep.
And take it on faith that there is some way of validating those, making sure that those are okay. Then when you get a new transaction that spends existing coins, points to one or more previous transactions. So those previous transactions, assuming that those previous transactions are valid, then they become spent, right? That's how you spend a transaction, is you create a new transaction that points to it and says, you know, those 50 Bitcoins over there, they now belong to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, if I see two transactions come over the wire that point to the same previous transaction, then the second one isn't valid because the first one already spent that value.
I see. So we need some kind of agreed upon time clock thingy going on. I know that from computer theory or computer science, that is actually quite hard to implement a distributed clock. Do we need that here?
We do need that there. And that really is the key idea that got solved with Bitcoin that made all of this possible.
Okay.
So nobody could figure out how to do that. So, I mean, the problem is, you know, it's easy to say, you know, the first transaction is valid and the second transaction that tries to spend the same Bitcoins is not valid. And that's easy to do in a centralized system. It's
right.
Just whichever one goes to the centralized server first. Decentralized, it's really hard because I could send one version of the transaction to half of the Bitcoin network and the different version of the transaction to the other half of the Bitcoin network. And the different parts of the network are going to see the Bitcoins in a different order.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's no strict ordering of, you know, how these messages flow across the internet. They can happen in different orders.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way Bitcoin solves that problem is very clever. And it's all tied up actually with the way new Bitcoins are created. So maybe I'll just dive in and then explain how all of that happens.
Right.
So the idea is everybody on the Bitcoin network, well, I shouldn't say everybody. Anybody who wants to on the Bitcoin network can try to generate new Bitcoins. The way you generate new Bitcoins is you watch for transactions going across the network. You bundle them up into what's called a block. You know, all of the valid transactions that you see, you put into a block. And then you run the proof of work algorithm on that block of data. So you're trying to find a particular number that when added to the block will make the hash of the block smaller than a particular target.
Just for people to remember, this is what we talked about when we talked about the crypto basics. The input to the hash algorithm, which is kind of almost random, is the transaction data. And then you have to run the hashing algorithm until you create a hash that has this criteria met, right?
Exactly. Lots of different people are trying to do that. And once they solve that problem, which takes on average across the entire network, it takes about 10 minutes for somebody on the network to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. Once they do, they announce that they've found a block. They announce that their block with all of the transactions that they consider valid. Everybody else on the network can very easily check to see that the block's hash is actually correct, that they actually did solve the proof of work problem. And then everybody else on the network will agree that those are the valid transactions. Mm-hmm. So that is the way that the whole network may not see the transactions in the same order, but whoever solves the block, essentially they get to decide, these are the valid transactions. This is the order that I saw the transactions. And so this is how everybody on the network is going to decide this version of this transaction is the correct version.
So it could happen that in our example, the second of the transactions is considered the valid one. But it can never happen that two are validated because only one can be considered valid by everybody and still point to the previous transaction we talked about.
Exactly, yes. I mean, if you had a bug in your Bitcoin software and you generated a block that had both versions of the transaction in it, everybody else on the network would reject your block. They would say, no, that's not valid because you have a double spend. You have two versions of this transaction.
Okay. So that means that this whole history for every coin is basically known to everybody.
Exactly, yes. This block generation process. Oh, and I should also mention that part of what you're also hashing is the hash of the previous block. Mm-hmm. So these blocks get organized in this long chain so that there's one record of, the history of the Bitcoin network and all of the transactions in it. Mm-hmm. So everybody agrees these are the valid blocks and these are the valid transactions. So yes, okay. It's a way of doing a distributed database of the entire history of the system.
So couldn't I create a completely separate history and just fake everything by creating a separate history that again rebuilds the whole chain for all of the transactions?
You could, although the proof of work is really hard. So, Bitcoin has been running for over 2 years now. The number of hashing calculations that have been done to create all of it's over 100,000 blocks now, is enormous. If you have a supercomputer, or actually a couple of supercomputers, at this point you probably could, because the Bitcoin is still fairly small, although it's rapidly approaching the point where even if you have a supercomputer, you would not be able to keep up with the combined computing power of the Bitcoin network. And so you would not be able to create valid blocks faster than everybody else in the Bitcoin network.
So I think I just got it, because I was going to ask why this proof of work is important. Why can't programs, the various clients, just agree that a certain transaction is valid and that a certain chain is valid? The trick of the proof of work is that you can't fake it, because you would have to redo all of these proof of work calculations.
Exactly. Yep. And the more popular Bitcoin gets, the harder that becomes to do. So, the more people involved and the more people running these proof of work calculations, the stronger the network becomes to somebody trying to cheat.
Now I get it. And all of these calculations are basically anchored by the second kind of transaction, which creates Bitcoins out of thin air.
Exactly. Yeah. Every block, you gather up transactions in the block. The first transaction in every block is a payment to yourself. It's a payment to one of your public keys.
Yeah.
And actually, the way the Bitcoin software works is it generates a new public key every time it tries to generate a block. So you mint a new block where the first transaction is what's called a Coinbase transaction that pays you, right now it will pay you 50 Bitcoins. So the reward for finding a block is 50 Bitcoins.
What you're saying is that the process of validating the other people's transactions earns me money.
Exactly. for doing the work of finding a valid block hash and for ensuring that you only include valid transactions in the blocks that you create, you get rewarded with new Bitcoins.
Mm-hmm. So if the whole history of Bitcoin is replicated to everybody, isn't that a huge amount of data that everybody has to keep track of and store?
Right now, it's about 150 megabytes worth of data, which in this era of terabyte hard drives is not a lot. Each transaction is actually very small. I believe transactions average somewhere around 400 bytes. So the transactions themselves are pretty small. As Bitcoin gets bigger and bigger, and there are more and more transactions, obviously that will grow. Eventually, it will probably only be kind of larger organizations who are paying attention to every single transaction. Mm-hmm. There's actually some really nice optimizations in the Bitcoin software so that you can not store every single transaction. You only need to store the transactions that are relevant to the transactions you care about. There actually are a bunch of optimizations we're just starting to implement some of those so that you don't have to store every single transaction on your disk. Although, again, as I said, right now it's about 150 megabytes for the entire history of the 2 years of Bitcoin so far. For the next couple of years, it probably won't be an issue. Although it would be nice if Bitcoin got really popular really fast and it did become an issue sooner. That would be a very nice problem to have.
Right. So let's visit again a little bit this creation of money. We said that money is created by having your client do work. And this work is used to validate, or this work constitutes the validation of other people's transactions. And we enforce that by making that validation process really hard by the proof of work we talked about before. But still, I could buy, you know, a bunch of computers, and if I'm the NSA, I could buy a lot of computers and basically create inflation in the network by just creating a lot of Bitcoins.
No. The interesting thing is the difficulty of the work is scaled by how quickly Bitcoins are being created. So if Bitcoins start to get created too fast, then the entire network agrees, yeah, the Bitcoins are being created too fast. Somebody must have a lot of compute power. So we're going to increase the requirements for generating a new block. We're going to make it harder so that on average, every 10 minutes, about 50 Bitcoins are created. And so there's a regular process of adjusting the difficulty of the proof of work so that there is no rampant inflation, so that no matter how much compute power you throw at the system, you'll just succeed in making it harder to create new Bitcoins such that about 50 Bitcoins will be created every 10 minutes. So far, that's worked really well. It's actually over 50,000 times harder to generate Bitcoins now than 2 years ago when Bitcoin started, which means there's 50,000 times more computers working on it. And yet Bitcoins are still being created about 50 Bitcoins every 10 minutes, just like they were 2 years ago when it was really easy to create them.
So how does it work? Couldn't I just write another client that doesn't obey to the agreement that there should be, you know, 50 every 10 minutes and just change the algorithm? Or I mean, I have a hard time understanding how a group of clients enforces something that nobody actually predefines, or is that somehow coded in the algorithm? How does this work?
Well, it is coded in the algorithm. And if you did that, you know, you could generate as many blocks as you like. Everybody else will see that your proof of work doesn't match. You didn't actually find the right hash value. You didn't actually, you know, spend a bunch of time trying to, you know, solve this hashing problem. And they would reject your blocks. So you could transmit, you know, your blocks to everybody else, and everybody else on the entire network would say, no, that's not valid. I'm not going to accept your new Bitcoins.
Okay. But again, you said that the requirements for creating Bitcoins are getting harder and harder over the years. How is that agreement reached?
Ah, I see. Well, essentially, it's every 2016 blocks, which is an odd number, but that works out to about if blocks are being created every 10 minutes, that works out to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So approximately every 2 weeks, and it's actually done as a block count, all of the Bitcoin clients look at the time the most recent block was created and the time that the block 2016 blocks ago was created. and they figure out, was that more or less than 2 weeks? If it was less than 2 weeks, then everybody runs the same calculation to say, well, we're generating Bitcoins too fast, and so the difficulty of creating Bitcoins has to be increased. And everybody runs the same calculation, so everybody agrees on the same what's called difficulty. If it took longer than 2 weeks, everybody actually does the opposite and says, oh, well, it took too long to generate those Bitcoins, and so we're going to make it a little bit easier to create Bitcoin. That actually hasn't happened on the main Bitcoin network for quite a while. It's because Bitcoin's becoming more popular and more people are joining.
Yeah. So, but it assumes that the majority of the Bitcoin clients are, you know, I don't know, truthful or non-hacked, so that they actually really do this calculation and do agree on, you know, make this measurement of how long it took to create things. If the majority of Bitcoin clients would be changed, then that algorithm could be hacked.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
When you say majority, it really depends on, you know, the majority of CPU power.
Yes.
You know, it's partly majority of CPU power, and then it's also majority of the nodes on the network. Because, you know, if you submit a block that I think is invalid because it doesn't have the right proof of work, you know, my Bitcoin client won't even bother sending it over to the rest of the network. It'll just drop it on the floor and say, no, that's not a valid block. I'm not going to relay that to other Bitcoin nodes.
Okay.
So you kind of both have to have the right majority of CPU power, and you have to have a majority of nodes on the Bitcoin network. And, you know, as the network grows, that becomes harder and harder to accomplish.
Right. So in some sense, the algorithm plays the role of the central bank and controls inflation, or allows a little bit of inflation by creating new money. But the amount of money is predetermined by the algorithm, by the people, I guess, who wrote the algorithm.
Yeah, the initial algorithm was determined by, you know, this one guy, Satoshi, who invented the system.
Mm-hmm.
The way he designed it was actually very rapid inflation at the beginning. You know, we are creating 50 Bitcoins every 10 minutes, which, you know, if you work it out compared to the number of Bitcoins in the first year, the second year had 100% inflation. The third year will have 25% inflation, and just in terms of the number of Bitcoins that are created, and so on and so forth. He actually designed the system so that the reward for creating a block decreases over time. So there'll be less and less inflation of the number of Bitcoins in the system until eventually 50 or 100 years from now, no more new Bitcoins will be created. It's designed to be kind of like a natural resource that you dig out of the ground.
Yeah.
It's easy to get lots when you start, and then over time it becomes harder and harder to find new Bitcoins.
I was going to say that, because if you follow the American politics a little bit, then I guess, I mean, not you personally, but I guess you do as an American, but people in general, then there is this discussion about whether it's a good idea that the US dollar is not backed by gold anymore, which makes it basically arbitrarily inflatable by just printing money or adding some numbers on an Excel spreadsheet, right?
Right.
And you cannot do that with Bitcoin.
No, you really can't. I mean, if you somehow manage to convince everybody running the Bitcoin software, oh, let's increase the reward for generating new Bitcoins to 10,000. I mean, then theoretically you could, but it's, you know, much harder to create, to convince, you know, a crowd of people on the internet to do anything than, you know, having a few people in Washington who actually theoretically could decide, just let's print more money this year, because actually they get together and they meet and they do. That's at least for the dollar, that's how the system works. Because you do have, you know, people at the Federal Reserve deciding how much new money to inject into the system every
right.
year. So depending on your political philosophy, Bitcoin does appeal to a lot of people who think that the kind of wisdom of crowds, more
right.
people working together, are smarter than having centralized control.
So what you're saying is that if, in case the majority or all of the Bitcoin users actually do agree that more inflation is useful, then that can be done by changing the algorithm. But it requires the majority of the people who have the money and spend the money.
Exactly, yes. And so, I mean, people who are running Bitcoin and people who have Bitcoins, you know, they have an incentive not to want to see inflation, because they don't want to see the value of their Bitcoins decrease.
Right.
So there's some pretty strong incentives built into the system, so that probably will never happen.
Right.
No. I have trouble imagining that everybody would decide, yeah, let's create a whole bunch of new Bitcoins so that the Bitcoins I already have are worth less.
Right, sure. That is hard to sell to people, I guess.
Yep.
But again, one last question on this. You said that in the beginning, the first year, there was 100% inflation. Now we're at, I guess, 25. Isn't that still quite a lot? Isn't that a problem?
Well, it hasn't been a problem so far, because as more people find out about Bitcoins, I mean, even though the supply has been going up, the demand has been going up even faster, because, mm-hmm. you know, many people have been finding out about Bitcoins. And so I think the system is actually working fairly well. The value of Bitcoins has been going up, not down, even though more Bitcoins are entering the system. Mm-hmm. And after 4 years, the rate of inflation gets cut in half, and is designed such that every 4 years it gets cut in half again.
Okay.
So it kind of goes to a limit of, the limit is 21 million Bitcoins will eventually be created, but there will never be more than 21 million of them.
And what happens if I need more money? Again, same problem as with gold, but what happens if we can't create any more money? Isn't that a problem? I mean, how can the economy grow if there isn't any more money?
Well, the nice thing about Bitcoins is they are very, very divisible. When I say there will be 21 million Bitcoins, there's actually 2.1 quadrillion of the smallest Bitcoin unit. Mm-hmm. So there are many places after the decimal point. So as we need more money, we can just pay with smaller and smaller amounts of Bitcoins. And that essentially is the same thing. You know, as Bitcoin becomes more popular, we have seen, you know, people used to pay 10,000 Bitcoins to buy a pizza.
Yeah.
Now 20 Bitcoins will buy you a really nice pizza, actually. Bitcoins are trading for about one Bitcoin per dollar, mm-hmm. in that range these days. In the future, if Bitcoins continue to become really popular and there's a lot of demand for them, you know, maybe you'll be paying micro Bitcoins for a pizza or millibitcoins for a pizza.
So what you're basically saying is that if you can't create any more money or dig out any more gold, then the existing money is going to get more and more valuable as the economy grows, and you need fewer amount of money to buy something with a given value, although the term value is, of course, hard to use in this context then.
Exactly.
I think that's called
deflation. Yeah.
Yeah, deflation, right. Yeah.
Yes, deflation. And I mean, to put things in perspective, I looked up the United States money supply is about 1 quadrillion pennies. So if you think about, you know, United States dollars, there's about 1 quadrillion pennies floating around in, you know, the M2 money supply. So 2.1 quadrillion, you know, of the smallest Bitcoin unit, that's probably going to be enough for quite a while. And there are technical things that could be done if more was ever needed, although I have trouble imagining that.
Yeah. So now that we have covered some of the technology behind it, is it a good idea to maybe again look at a transaction and taking into account the public-private key stuff and how the signing and the validation of transaction works, maybe just, you know, as a kind of recap?
Sure. So let's say that I start with 50 Bitcoins that I generated that are assigned to one of my public-private keys. So I got lucky. I managed to solve this hard problem. You know, my computer hashed away for a month or a year and actually managed to generate a block.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody agrees that that block is valid. So now I have 50 Bitcoins that are assigned to one of my public keys. That public key is part of the block, so everybody knows that public key.
Mm-hmm.
And now I want to send it to you. So the way I do that, the way the Bitcoin software does that, is I take your public key, which you give me in the form of a Bitcoin address. I create a new transaction where I say, these 50 Bitcoins that I created are now assigned to Marcus's public key, and here's his public key. And then I sign that transaction with my private key.
Mm-hmm.
If we remember, the digital signature algorithm ensures that only I can generate that transaction. Everybody else can verify that, yes, that digital signature is valid. Whoever created that digital signature had to have access to the private key that corresponds to the public key. And so the whole rest of the network will say, yep, that's a valid transaction. Those 50 Bitcoins were created as part of a block that we all agree was created properly,
mm-hmm.
Signed by a valid signature. So we know that, you know, only Gavin could have signed it. And they don't actually know it's Gavin. They just know,
yeah,
whoever owns that private key signed it. And now it's assigned to this public key that happens to belong to you, Marcus. Mm-hmm. And that transaction is transmitted to the network. If your Bitcoin client is connected to the network when it's transmit, then you'll see it right away, and your Bitcoin software will show it to you. If you don't happen to be connected to the Bitcoin network, then it just gets transmitted to the network. It will be included in a block, and then the next time you log on, your Bitcoin client will download all of the blocks. It will see that new block that has that transaction to you, and it will say, "Oh, great! You know, I just got 50 Bitcoins from mm-hmm. From somewhere." It will increase your Bitcoin balance.
Right. Okay.
And so that under the covers, that is exactly how transactions happen and how they work.
So the balance is basically the client counting all the valid transactions that involve my public key as the receiver of money.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's maybe just to recap, continue the recap, look at the typical attack modes people could have. One way of attacking the system is to spend the same money again. This doesn't work because
only the first transaction that a node sees is included in the block. So once the transaction is put into a block, that is the reality, and that is the valid transaction. Any other transactions that come after that spend the same prior transactions are considered invalid, and you know, the rest of the network will just reject them.
Okay. The other thing is I can create new money and then spend it is prevented by...
Again, you know, everybody checks to make sure that your block is valid, that you did enough work. If you did, then your block will be accepted by the rest of the network. If you didn't, then your block will just be dropped on the floor. Now, I should probably also mention that there is a possibility that two people will generate a block at about the same time.
Yeah.
And that's called a block race. And so both blocks will get transmitted onto the network. And the way that is resolved is essentially the same way as a double spent transaction. You know, when I mentioned that each block includes the previous block's hash, if I'm working on a new block, then whichever block I see first will be the one that I point to. Mm-hmm. And so if I see two blocks come in at about the same time, well, whichever one I get first will be the first one that I include as the previous block. I'll just ignore the other one. And then if I happen to get lucky and generate the next proof of work, then I will build on top of that previous block and announce it. So if there is a block race and two blocks are generated at about the same time, the next block that's created gets to decide which one of those two is valid.
Okay.
And that can repeat, you know, in as computer geeks, we're pretty comfortable with the idea of recursion.
Yep.
And, you know, just doing the same thing over and over. So block races could theoretically repeat, but since blocks are created about every 10 minutes, and since computer networks are pretty darn fast, fairly quickly, one ordering of the blocks will be accepted by the majority of the network as this is the valid blockchain.
Yeah.
And the longest blockchain is always what's considered the reality. So
okay, because most other people have accepted it and built new transactions on top of it.
Exactly. But so the majority of the network will quickly accept. And then when I say quickly, I mean within like 20 minutes
right.
or half an hour.
But that means that if I do a transaction, it might take a while until it is considered valid.
Yes. So... the danger is that, you know, I send out a double spend transaction and, you know, it one version of the transaction might be in one fork of the blockchain and another in another fork of the blockchain.
Yep.
And then if I'm receiving that money, I need to decide, you know, well, which one of these transactions should I actually accept as valid? You know, I may not be certain which version of the blockchain will eventually be the canonical
right.
version that everybody accepts. So if you want to be absolutely almost, you know, 110% sure that you have the right version, you should wait for the blockchain to get long enough. And typically, six transactions is considered, you know, there's no way somebody could generate a longer blockchain than six. So once the six blocks have been built on top of the block that contains the transaction, that's considered very, very safe.
Okay. And a block doesn't contain the transactions of only one set of Bitcoins. It's a record of transactions. So I don't have to spend myself six other things so the one thing gets valid. It's just the network has to do six other transactions and chain them into the whole history, the whole, you know, life of Bitcoin to make it considered, to make it be considered the truth.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's actually, if you read the technical paper, there was a technical paper describing the Bitcoin system in detail.
Yeah.
There are actually calculations in the back of it that describe, you know, given an attacker who's trying to double spend on the network, assuming they have a certain percentage of the computing power, you know, how likely are they to be able to pull off a double spending transaction based on how many confirmations you wait, how many blocks are built on top of the transaction. And it's a nice exponential function that drops off really quickly. And so actually for low value transactions, a lot of people are just accepting one confirmation, you know, into one block
right.
as valid, and assuming that they haven't seen another attempt to double spend, you know, go across the network, they'll assume with one transaction that the transaction is valid.
Right. But okay. So just to unwind our discussion stack here, we were talking about creating money. It is actually feasible that instead of having one computer running a Bitcoin client, I buy 10 of them, and then the likelihood of creating new money out of thin air is 10 times that. Okay. Right?
Yes. That's
okay.
True. Yep.
Good. But in the end, you could argue that at some point my electricity bill will become higher than the money, you know, more expensive than the money that's created. So in some sense, you could argue that it's not feasible to just buy more and more and more hardware.
Yeah. At some point, it does become not cost effective. And right now, the people who are really serious, there are people who are very serious about generating Bitcoins and have invested a lot of money in hardware to specifically to try to generate more Bitcoins than other people. And right now, unless you have a fairly high-end graphics processor, you know, these graphics processors that do 3D graphics really well,
yep.
It probably is not cost-effective just to use your CPU to generate Bitcoins because the graphics processors are much, much faster. And things are even moving beyond that. There are some people who are creating custom chips that will generate Bitcoins more efficiently.
Okay.
So I know for a fact that, you know, one person is in the process of deploying some systems with custom chips that, you know, he gets a better number of Bitcoins produced per watt of electricity that, you know, he has to buy than using computer graphics cards. So there is kind of an arms race going on in with people trying to generate Bitcoins as efficiently as possible. And that's assuming that, you know, Bitcoin continues to become more and more popular and they get more and more valuable, that's likely to continue. And the, you know, marginal cost of producing a Bitcoin will probably be driven to, you know, whatever the lowest electricity price is in the world. So
yeah.
There's a lot of speculation on, you know, which countries will be big Bitcoin producing countries based on, you know, access to inexpensive electricity.
Funny. But the thing is, also in this case, there is a relationship between actual work done and actual hardware installed and actually time computed and the money created. It's still not like fake. It's still actually people doing work and building hardware.
It is, yes. Yeah, the economics of it are interesting because people sometimes think, well, you know, the value of Bitcoins will be tied to the value of electricity.
Yep.
But that's not really right. It's more the, you know, the demand for Bitcoins would drive the value. And then the amount of effort people put into trying to create them will be driven by that value versus the value of the electricity you have to put into it. So, you know, if Bitcoins become more valuable, you'll see more people trying to generate them, but that will be limited by their electricity costs. So,
right.
You know,
yeah.
at some point it becomes cheaper just to buy Bitcoins rather than, you know, waste a lot of electricity trying to generate them.
Right. The third and last attack that I had in mind was trying to create a complete alternative history of the whole Bitcoin system. But we talked about that already before and mentioned that this is just computationally way too expensive and therefore unfeasible once the system is out of its, you know, hello world days.
Yeah, that's true. And there's also actually every release of the Bitcoin software, we actually put a kind of a safety check in. We hard code one of the block hashes from a while ago
So
that even if you had a supercomputer, you couldn't mess up the whole system by generating the entire blockchain. Because there are these checkpoints in there where we say, you know, this block was generated a month ago. We don't want anybody to come back and say, you know, that block generated a month ago is no longer valid. So, you know, we put in these checkpoints in the software.
Yeah.
Kind of as a sanity check or a safety check.
Yeah.
And I think we'll probably see more of that as the Bitcoin grows. I think you might see kind of the major exchanges and the major merchants kind of agreeing among themselves that, yeah, you know, this, we saw this block 2 hours ago, and we're all going to agree that, you know, no matter what happens, we're going to consider that block valid.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see kind of what other, you know, safety measures are put in place.
Yeah. So last question in the technical part, how do the nodes actually communicate? It's basically a peer-to-peer network, right? So everybody talks to everybody else. How is that technically done?
Yeah, it's actually a randomly or mostly randomly connected peer-to-peer network. So when you start your Bitcoin software, well, when you start it for the very first time, there are a couple different ways that it finds other Bitcoin nodes. It connects to an IRC chat channel that Bitcoin nodes just hang out in, essentially. And so it sees whether Bitcoin nodes are hanging out in the Bitcoin chat channel. It chooses 8 nodes at random and tries to connect to them. Mm-hmm. Now, when it actually chooses those 8, it's not entirely random. It actually tries to choose kind of different parts of the internet. You don't want to connect to somebody who's trying to fool you. So, you know, you could imagine somebody trying to get all 8 of your connections, you know, connect to me and I will follow the rules. You want to connect to, you know, different nodes. So it actually picks nodes that have very different IP addresses. Okay. So it'll connect to 8 nodes initially using the IRC chat channel. And then once it is connected to the Bitcoin network, Bitcoin nodes trade addresses of other Bitcoin nodes that they know about. So pretty quickly, your Bitcoin node will generate a database of, you know, other nodes on the Bitcoin network.
Yeah.
So that in the future, you'll still typically connect to the IRC chat channel so that other nodes can connect to you, but you also have a local database of, you know, IP addresses where you know Bitcoin is running.
So the chat channel is like a kind of distributed naming service or directory. And the rest communicates via, I mean, in some sense, the client acts like a router and knows other people it can talk to.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and your client acts as a relay transmitting messages from nodes to other nodes.
Okay.
And again, I said it's essentially randomly connected network, which actually works surprisingly well.
But can't I shut down the system by spamming or killing or whatever, doing something to the IRC channel?
Well, you can make it harder for nodes to connect. So there are actually 3 ways that new Bitcoin clients find nodes. There's the IRC chat channel. There's actually a hard-coded list of IP addresses of what are called seed nodes, mm-hmm. part of the Bitcoin software that we distribute. And we update that list, you know, every 6 months or so to be long-running, you know, well-known Bitcoin nodes that you can connect to do this initial connection bootstrapping.
Yep.
And then there's actually even a third way you can, you know, when you run the Bitcoin software, you can specify, please connect directly to the node IP address.
Yeah, that's good because that's a different channel.
Exactly, yes. And there may be other ways of bootstrapping. That's just called the bootstrapping problem. It's always a problem with peer-to-peer networks of, you know, how do you find other peers to connect to? So with these 3 different ways of bootstrapping, it's, you know, pretty well covered, and it would be easy to invent other ways of bootstrapping in the future if necessary or if, you know, connecting to the IRC chat channel becomes a problem, which I could imagine it eventually becoming a problem if there were millions of, you know, Bitcoin nodes.
Yeah.
Probably don't want to connect to an IRC channel with a million people. That could overwhelm it.
So the only way for the government to shut down Bitcoin is to shut down the internet, I guess. If that would happen, then things are kind of bad luck.
Yeah, we'd have all sorts of other problems if the government tried to shut down the internet. So...
Yeah,
not one of my big worries.
No. Okay, then let's move on to the third part or to the last part, which is basically a wrap-up. Can you say something about the adoption? You already said that some charities, I think the EFF is accepting donations in Bitcoin. I heard the rumor that PayPal also allows you to pay in Bitcoin. True?
I don't think that's true yet.
Okay, then I'm wrong.
Unless I missed an announcement. It would be nice if Bitcoin was one of the currencies that, you know, PayPal allowed you to hold. Essentially, they'd function as yet another, you know, online wallet service.
Yep.
That would be great, and I could imagine that happening. But as far as I know, that hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
Yeah, adoption has really started to take off. I should say I first heard about Bitcoin last May. And back then, the Bitcoin project had been going on for, you know, almost a year and a half. And it hadn't really got much adoption. And Bitcoins weren't worth very much. There were only a few people using it.
Yeah.
As it's gotten older and as more and more people have looked at it and decided, you know, this thing could really work and we don't see any problems with it. And as, you know, websites have started to make it easier to use Bitcoin and people have started to accept Bitcoins and the exchanges have happened so you can exchange Bitcoins for dollars or euros, it's really started to take off. I mean, mm-hmm. It's still very early days and there's still, you know, there are only maybe 100 or so merchants that accept Bitcoins for products and services, but that's growing pretty rapidly. So, you know, soon I wouldn't be surprised if there were thousands of merchants
cool.
that are accepting Bitcoins for products and services. And as you'd imagine for a virtual currency, most of the products and services are internet related. Although I'm actually wearing some very nice socks that I bought for Bitcoin. So.
Okay, and I guess we can put some links to sites and stuff into the show notes that are relevant there that do accept Bitcoin to give people an example.
Yep, there's a nice list on the Bitcoin Wiki that has a list of sites that accept Bitcoins for all sorts of things.
Right, so we'll just link to that one. What do you think, what is the core computer science trick or achievement or advance that made this possible?
Yeah, the one big thing, I mean, cryptocurrencies have been an idea that have been around since the late 90s. So, you know, it's been talked about for a long time, but figuring out how to solve the double spending problem in a decentralized fashion, that was the key idea that lets the whole system work. Mm-hmm. So this whole notion of using proof of work to generate this blockchain, and that's a way of having a distributed database where the order is well defined and agreed upon by everybody without having, you know, one central clearinghouse.
Yep.
That's the key idea that nobody had been able to figure out before that really makes this unique and makes the whole thing work.
Mm-hmm. Is that trick used for other things in addition to cryptocurrencies? I guess, I mean, because distributed clocks and global ordering is a big deal in general.
Yeah, it is a big deal in general. And there have been, there's been a lot of discussion of using essentially the same technique to order other things. Like, you know, there's been the talk about doing a distributed DNS system so that you don't have, you know, one organization in control of domain names.
Yeah.
But instead, you have a Bitcoin-like system where first come, first serve, and the first is defined essentially in the same way as Bitcoin decides which transaction came first.
Right.
So there's been a lot of discussion about that. That might happen. You know, you can imagine other places where you want a distributed timestamping service is essentially what it is. And so, yeah, it could be reused for interesting things. We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. So you're developing some kind of add-on product to the regular Bitcoin client, right?
I'm actually developing web services around Bitcoin. So the first web service I created is actually pretty famous. It's called the Bitcoin Faucet. And it will give you just a few Bitcoins to play with. So I record your IP address and I give out 0.05 Bitcoins per unique IP address. So you can go to freebitcoins.appspot.com and get some free Bitcoins from the Bitcoin Faucet just to play with. And I did that basically to make it easier just to get a few Bitcoins so that you can play with it. You can try it. You can see what Bitcoin is like because you may not want to spend your own money to play with this crazy new virtual currency thing.
So,
but if you can get a few for free.
So people spend your money or do you have a bunch of graphics cards creating new ones?
Actually, I invested $50 to buy 10,000 Bitcoins way back last April.
Okay.
So that gives you an idea of how much Bitcoins were worth when I first found out about Bitcoin.
Right.
And so far, I have not run out of Bitcoins to fund the Bitcoin faucet.
But you could take these Bitcoins and exchange them back and be quite rich, or am I missing something?
No, those 10,000 Bitcoins, well, I've given most of them away. I have some Bitcoins left that I use to refund the faucet when it's almost empty.
Okay.
But yeah, if I had, well, if I had held on to them, they'd be worth about $10,000 now instead of the $50 that I originally invested. Although I like to think that if I hadn't done the Bitcoin faucet, then Bitcoins, maybe they'd only still be worth $50 because not as many people would have to get them and play with them. So.
Yeah, it's still a pretty good deal. I mean, you get, that might actually be an investment opportunity. I mean, we're not doing any money investment advice here, blah, 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 legal speak, but right. It sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the value of Bitcoins has definitely risen as they've become more popular and as more people have found out about them. So, again, you know, treat it as an incredibly high risk investment because who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I also bought some other Bitcoins way back then that I've held on to and that I used to, you know, buy the very nice socks that I'm wearing. and I have a couple other Bitcoin-related projects that are using the Bitcoin technology to do interesting things. So that's. Yeah. I'm trying to spend about half of my time kind of working on the core Bitcoin open source project and the other half working on my own Bitcoin related projects.
If people want to join the project, not just use Bitcoin, but rather help with the project, a bunch of programmers might listen to this. How do they get in touch?
Bitcoin.org is the main website.
Okay.
I found out about Bitcoin over a year after it started, and I just jumped in and started doing things. I just jumped in and started, you know, I saw some code that needed writing, so I submitted patches to the code. And there's Bitcoin, the Bitcoin forums is where, you know, new code changes are discussed, and we're talking about, you know, what do you want to see Bitcoin software do in the future, and how should we tweak the network protocol to make it more efficient. And, you know, all of these things are done completely in the open because it is an open source project. And there's really no barrier for anybody to jump in and just start helping. You know, we could use lots of help with making the software easier to use, making it more secure, making the website prettier. You know, there are lots of things for people to do if they're interested.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I guess you probably know that recently Security Now covered Bitcoin. That's also where I learned about it.
Yep.
I guess that they probably have more of an audience who consists of, you know, developers who might want to join. But maybe somebody's listening here as well. Who never knows.
Yep, we'll see. More help, the better. I mean, the more people who jump in and contribute creative ideas. You know, another reason I'm really excited about Bitcoin is it really is kind of a people's currency. I mean, where the people are right now are geeks,
yes.
You know, people who really understand cryptography and some of these other advanced concepts. But it's kind of a grassroots movement to create a new money system. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I contacted you. I think it's a very nice illustration of crypto stuff, and it's also something that is really useful, at least potentially, to have a currency that is not prone to whatever you want your government, what you think your government does to it. Let's say it this way. I'm not necessarily a conspiracy person, but still, I mean, it's nice to see something completely independent.
Yep, it's completely independent, and I think the key thing is that it's completely predictable. So,
yes, absolutely.
You know, we know how many Bitcoins are going to be created next year. So, you know, we may not know how many people are going to be using Bitcoin next year, but at least, you know, there are some predictable properties that you can use to make some assumptions about what's going to happen.
Right. Okay, then I guess that's it. I have no more questions unless you want to say something in addition to what we've talked about. I guess we're kind of at the end.
Great. No, it was fantastic talking to you.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time.
Cool. And actually, one more thing I might mention is just this morning, it was announced that Google has come out with an alternative implementation of the Bitcoin system.
Ah, same protocol, but different implementation.
Same protocol implemented in Java. That's really exciting. So now, as of this morning, we have two independent implementations of Bitcoin, which is really great news.
Absolutely.
And should help the kind of stability, and it makes me breathe a little bit easier because, you know, that scenario I said where maybe there's one bug that affects all of the software on the network. Well,
right.
If there are two independent implementations, then that's not going to happen. You know, there will still be the other implementation.
Right.
So that was exciting news this morning.
Absolutely. And this morning is March 7. So I don't know when this will be published. So this March 7 is the exciting day.
Yep.
Okay, thanks, and talk to you later about this stuff.
All right, talk to you later, Marcus.
Bye. Okay, that's it once again. I'm really fascinated by this stuff. I mean, it's a very real-world use case for kind of very interesting theoretical concepts, and this whole story about distributed clocks and global ordering, something that had been an issue in computer science for a long time. Also, I think, I mean, in the past, you've heard all these stories how Twitter and Facebook were the reasons for the revolutions in Egypt and other places, and I'm not completely convinced. I mean, they certainly had a role to play, but I'm not sure it's as important as it sounds. But this kind of project really shows how, with the internet, you can create infrastructures that are independent of the classical infrastructures as they are organized typically by governments. And I think it's an interesting addition to what we already have. So, really fascinating. Okay. That's it. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye.
As I was walking alone, I heard two ravens making moan. One to the other say, shall we go and dine today? Shall we go and dine today? Out behind the old fair dyke, I know there lies a new slain knight. Nobody knows that he is there, his hound is hawking his lady fair. His hound is hawking his lady fair. But his hound is to the hunting gone. He's hawked to fetch the wildfowl. His lady taking another maid. Shall make our dinner
Omega Tau, Science and Engineering in Your Headphones. Produced by Nora Ludewig and Markus Völter. Licensed under the Creative Commons Non-Derivative License 3.0, which means you can use the content for non-commercial purposes, you cannot change anything, and you have to attribute the source, omegataupodcast.net. For more details, see creativecommons.org. The music is from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Omega Tau is on the web at omegataupodcast.net. You can become a fan on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Omega Tau Podcast. We appreciate any feedback either as a comment on the website, via email to feedback@omegataupodcast.net, or as a self-recorded MP3 via email. Thanks for downloading and listening to this episode of Omega Tau.